Hi, I'm Jason Bradford.
I'm Ashir Miller.
And this is Rob Dietz. You're listening to Crazy Town, where the National Guard hands out Soylent Green rations.
Hey, Ashir, Jason, you know, we've been recording since well before the pandemic began, and we've got a couple episodes we released this past week. And I wanted to talk about something that struck me on our rationing episode, pointed out by a listener. So we got an email, and anybody else that wants to send us an email, that's crazytown@postcarbon.org. So we got an email from a listener named Don, who is 84 years old.
That's like average age for our,
our audience. That's our demographic.
Maybe, but hey, whatever, you know, the older folks have the wisdom, right?
So, yes.
Run away from us. So,
right. So speaking of running, he said that episode jogged a lot of memories.
That's good. We have very funny listeners as well.
Yeah. But he said that it jogged a lot of memories about how he used to self-ration. So he said he would drive 55 miles per hour on the highway while people blasted by him.
Didn't he know that we said 35? He was supposed to be doing 35.
Yeah, well, maybe he didn't want to die just yet, you know. Yeah. But anyway, he said over time, over many years, he lost interest in doing it because he felt so alone, you know, that there wasn't other people who were along for the ride with him. You know, everyone's doing 85 while he's doing 55.
Yeah.
So I thought it was just, it struck me how it really reiterated what we were talking about, that it's got to be a shared sacrifice.
Yeah.
It's not a every person for themselves kind of deal. It's got to be everybody working together and giving up something for a, you know, for the meaningfulness, for the bigger cause.
Totally. Yeah. Who wants to sacrifice when all these other schmucks are just partying on?
So we're not partying on right now, right? So it's kind of interesting to see that in the midst of this crisis, we are seeing people making sacrifices. You know, I read a piece about a bunch of these nail salons sending equipment to hospitals because they have a lot of gloves, you know, that they use when they're doing stuff, right? So they send them to them.
That's good. I was thinking they were sending fingernail polish, which just doesn't seem as useful as some of the other equipment.
No, but go ahead, Jason.
Well, I've heard we are consuming some things more, like alcohol. Apparently, that's way up.
You know, essential. Those are essentials. But some people are doing this, obviously. But it's kind of crazy, you know. To our listener's point, it's crazy to ask people, or maybe it's not that efficient or effective to ask some people to kind of voluntarily do it when others aren't doing it, right? And we have this like crazy situation now with these PPEs and other things that are really, really necessary for this pandemic. I don't know if you guys heard the governor of New York, Cuomo, talking about this recently.
That's fantastic.
Maybe we'll play that clip.
Yeah, I haven't heard it. Let's give me the clip and we'll play it.
All right.
Look at the bizarre situation we wind up in. Every state does its own purchasing. So New York is purchasing, California is purchasing, Illinois is purchasing. We're all trying to buy the same commodity, literally the same exact item. So you have 50 states competing to buy the same item. We all wind up bidding up each other and competing against each other, where you now literally will have a company call you up and say, well, California just outbid you. It's like being on eBay with 50 other states bidding on a ventilator. And you see the bid go up because California bid, Illinois bid, Florida bid, New York bids, California rebids. That's literally what we're doing. I mean, how inefficient. And then FEMA gets involved and FEMA starts bidding. And now FEMA is bidding on top of the 50. So FEMA is driving up the price. What sense does this make?
Yeah. So guys, what sense does this make? What do you think? Does this make a lot to you?
Doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense, does it?
I was like laughing and crying. It's just so freaking absurd
Well, it's worse than that, Jason. So, okay. You know, since he made that statement, it's come out that FEMA, you know, FEMA is actually bidding on things and trying to collect stuff now. So we have another party at play here.
Right.
And they've made a deal. They made a deal with these distributors. And there's a case to be made to say, well, these companies that distribute these things, they've got the infrastructure in place to do it. But they made a deal with them where FEMA gets to direct 50% of the PPEs that come in to hotspots, the zones that need them the most. But then they're leaving the distributors the other 50% to sell them basically to the highest bidder. And FEMA, you can actually see they have like a graphic depicting how this works and how this makes sense.
Well, doesn't that mean, though, that FEMA is then going to be paying a lot more money than they normally would have to because these states and the hospitals are bidding it up, and then FEMA is going in and buying also?
Right. By the way, I won't get political here, but kind of see the rationale for a single-payer healthcare system in general in this, because that happens with healthcare and insurance more broadly, right?
Yes, this is a prime example.
You know, I think you guys are missing the point. When Cuomo was talking, he sounded to me just like my Econ 101 professor describing perfect competition, which is the capitalist ideal.
It wasn't a rhetorical question. What sense does this make? He's actually saying, what sense does this make, right?
I think he's honestly calling into question the economic system the same way that we do, right? That it's, should it always be that you allocate goods and services based on ability to pay? Is that necessarily the best way to
Why I think that ratcheting episode was so perfect, even though we recorded it ahead of time. I mean, it's like we record it and then 3 months later, it's like a perfect example of why we need a rational rationing system, non-price based, according to need, not price.
Yeah, well, you know, you've got incredible powers to predict the future, Jason. I'm in awe now.
Well, I saw this. Some slides someone had created. I can't remember who or where. You know, I saw it on Facebook or YouTube. I don't know, but it was every Time magazine headline about pandemics. And over the last like 20 years, it's like every year they have some. You know, 1 week of year, Time has a cover.
So what you're saying is that no one could see this coming. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, this is what, I mean, you just said that about me, but it's like anyone who pays attention can see the shit show that's due, whether it's climate change or resource depletion or debt overhang and financial crises. The system we know is just on the brink. And so, sure, I mean, we didn't know exactly what was going to go down, but this is what we've been expecting, something to pop the bubble.
Well, people who've been dealing with health experts worried about pandemics, this is not a new thing, obviously.
No.
And I listened to one of them talk about the fact that it's a no-win situation for them, because if they come out ringing alarm bells when a new risk arrives. You know, we had Ebola, we had H1N1, we've actually had a series of these things.
Yeah.
You know, in the last couple decades. And, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you do and you're like ringing alarm bells, telling, you know, people that we have to take these drastic measures, and then maybe because of the measures you've taken, it's not that bad. People are like, oh, you're a total alarmist. You know, like this was a huge mistake. If you don't act, right, then people blame you for failing to act. And I think that that's true for anyone who's warning about any of these systemic risks that we face.
Right, totally. Well, you know, I remember something that also struck me in that episode was that we talked about, like at the end, like what to do was sort of become frugal, you know, ride your bike more, learn how to garden and procure your own food, because that's not going to be part of whatever rationing program is set up to deal with this future crisis. I saw this news report about Oregon State University runs a master gardener vegetable gardening program, right? And it's online. So typically it costs $45 to join this. It's a short course online and they teach you how to garden. And I emailed them saying, because I saw this article saying this, that they had huge signups because they waived that $45 in late March. Okay. And apparently the signups were huge. So I said, well, how many have signed up and how many sign up normally? And the response they got is kind of shocking. So normally they get 150 to 300 takers each year. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
How many signed up as of Friday? Okay. We're recording this on Monday. As of Friday, I got an email back from them. How many signed up?
I'm going to go crazy and say they had a tenfold increase. Let's say they had like, I don't know, 1,500 or 2,000 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. I will, but just to...
You know, Price is Right it, and you're just going to go $1 more?
I'm going to go 40 million okay. Signups.
Yeah,
I'm going to win this one. I'm going to win this one. What's my prize, by the way?
I'll get you a
you'll sign me up for the class.
Yeah, let them take the class.
I'll get you an artichoke. Okay. 25,000.
25,000?
Yes.
Wow. So I'm going to admit to you that I'm one of the sign-ups
good for you.
Of the 25,000. Except here's the fun part about the pandemic and being online. It gives you all kinds of opportunities to screw things up. So I tried to sign up for, you know, what I thought would be like the basics of gardening kind of thing, you know. I mean, I already kind of know the basics. You put the seed in the soil, you water it, you know, but I thought I would increase my knowledge, improve my skill. And I ended up signing up for the course that explains what the Master Gardening program is. So it's really just a course about what the course is. So not particularly
boring.
Yeah. So that's my, you know who you're dealing with here. Someone who can't even sign up for the right course.
But what you're talking about, Jason, here is, I mean, obviously the free thing, you know, probably helped.
That helps.
But
yeah.
I think just anecdotally, I've already seen huge spike in people just walking around my neighborhood.
Yeah.
I swear to God, like every third house is planting a garden, partly because people have nothing else to do. But I think, you know, in the Great Recession, 2009, 2010, there were 10 million new gardens planted in the United States. And that mm-hmm. was because of need, right?
Yeah.
I bet we're blowing that number.
Yeah. And it's causing problems on the supply chain of just getting garden inputs. So I'm farming this year for a CSA. And I did the math and I figured, okay, I need 300 pounds of potato starts. So these are called seed potatoes. And you basically put them in the ground, you make new potatoes, right? So potatoes make potatoes.
It's magic.
So I need 300.
Were you doing this like the, what was that movie about the guy being stuck on Mars?
Yes.
The Martian.
Yeah.
Matt Damon. So, but potatoes are incredible. Okay.
Are you doing it that way? You know,
well,
capturing
your urine
and your poop and like.
It's going to take more than me. I'm going to need everyone to come out and poop in the potato patch. Yeah. So there's a lot of potatoes. These are big.
What about social distancing?
One at a time. Yeah. So I need 300 pounds of potatoes. So I go looking for potato starts and like, we're sold out. I finally found what I wanted in Idaho. So anyway, I'm getting.
Are you going to drive out there and get it?
No, it should be on the way. Cross my fingers. So anyway, yeah, it's fascinating what's going on.
Well, I want to move us along from thinking about rationing to the other episode we recorded, which was about delusion and denial when it comes to climate change and economics, where remember we were talking about how the left side of the political spectrum has this delusion problem, thinking we can have green growth, you know, we'll make a transition to renewables and just keep everything peachy and rosy and the economy exponentially growing. And then, of course, on the right side of the political spectrum, you've got denial of the severity of the problems. So I was wondering, in our current crisis, what strikes you guys on the delusion and denial front?
Well, thinking about denial, how about we've seen such a contrast in terms of response from government, right? I mean, we had Trump kind of denying that this was going to be a problem at all, you know, and then switching. But we've had governors. You know, I think the role of governors has been really interesting because we have 50 different government institutions, you know, with 50 different leaders kind of responding in different ways, right? And the denial of the problem on the part of some governors is really amazing. and very obviously worrisome. And on the flip side, you have maybe delusions on the part of people who think that, like, investor types. It's been really fascinating for me to see, you know, the market obviously went to complete and utter shit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's had a bit of a rally. And I just look at that and I think, these guys are delusional. What, do they think we're going to have a V-shaped recovery, like, tomorrow or something?
It's nuts. Like, in the Boeing, I remember when there was all this concern about international flights and it spreading this. And I'm watching this going, right, the airline industry is going to freaking shut down any day now, okay? I'm like, begging it to shut down. And Boeing stock was going up. This was like late February.
Well, that's because they were selling military jets.
Could be.
So the thing that you just reminded me of, a share, you talked about the Great Recession a few minutes ago, and now you're talking about a V-shaped recovery for this one. Things are so screwy right now. I think we're in for a renaming of the Great Recession, kind of like World War I got renamed, you know, right. That's going to be like the mediocre recession, or the recession that wasn't so bad.
The recession we wish we had now.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, the best part about the episode was, for me, this is not very profound, was at the end we made a joke about using Meatloaf autographed Meatloaf pictures as toilet paper.
Now, you're talking Meatloaf the artist, not the artist. Actual Meatloaf toilet paper.
No.
Although there might, I don't know, meat's in short supply too, so we might not be wise to make toilet paper out of meat.
For all those Meatloaf fans, the super hardcore Meatloaf fans who got their autographed toilet paper, are they getting to the point where they're like, God, do I have to use this?
Right.
Can I hold on to this? I mean, that's, talk about a real conundrum. Right?
Use leaves for a while.
What about those who really don't care for Meatloaf and is climate denying? That's easy. You just reach for the stack right away.
Right.
Well, you know, there's delusion denial, but, you know, not to get too alliterative here. How about a third D of distraction?
Mm-hmm.
Something that's really come up for me. I read an article about the Dakota Access Pipeline, and it just really kind of stirred something in me. I think it would have been front page news, a really big deal. Has everything to do with what we talk about on this show, you know, the conflict between the economy and the environment. And it was just kind of passed over real quickly. So what the story was about is the permit for being able to run the pipeline. And if you go back to the year 2016, the Standing Rock Sioux had a movement that they had organized to oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline. And that pipeline was set up to bring shale oil down, you know, this fracked crude oil down from the Bakken oil field up in North Dakota and Montana and bring that oil down to Texas. But protesters were concerned all about the water quality issues that would happen, the leaks, and also some intrusion on sacred lands. And there was a big battle. Like, the police used all these violent tactics, attack dogs, water cannons.
Yeah.
And it was winter, mm-hmm. tear gas. One activist, Sophia Wolanski, nearly had her arm blown off in the mm-hmm. standoff. It was a really tense time, and it was front page news. And the Obama administration ended up rescinding the permit that the pipeline company had. And then the Trump administration ended up reinstating it. So in May of 2017, oil started pumping through that pipeline.
Yeah.
And the news story that I just read is that on March 25th, a federal judge tossed the permits and ordered a full environmental review. So you've got this federal court saying that it was illegal, and that's quite a win for the protesters and for the idea of, let's keep the fossil fuels, especially this fracked fossil fuel, from making it to market, and just glossed over.
Yeah. Do you know what why he why she stopped the case or stopped the movement of the oil or the permit?
I don't have the specifics on it, but I do know the company that built the pipeline has a terrible record of leaks. And basically, I don't think their operation was anywhere near as clean or mm-hmm. likely to be as clean as had been predicted.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, that's not the only news in the energy world. You guys remember about a month ago, Saudi Arabia and Russia couldn't come up with an agreed upon amount of cuts, right, to oil output and oil prices, crude oil prices plummeted.
Saudis wanted to make cuts, right?
Yeah, and they wanted to make cuts.
And Russians basically refused.
Yeah. Right? So the price absolutely plummeted, right? And this was a month ago. And of course, what's happened since then is obviously consumption of oil products has plummeted. And so the price just kept going down and stayed down. And what then starts happening is if it can't get burned, it has to go into storage facilities. And that's not an economically viable solution long-term for anybody who's pumping it and needs to get paid. So there's just tremendous changes happening. And it's hard to know how much oil consumption is down. There's some reports of 35 million barrels a day out of 100 million barrels a day. But it's actually hard to know. Apparently, it's difficult to get this information, and it's not reported in a timely manner.
What's messing with my head is how cheap gas has become.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is around the country, but here we're looking at $2 a gallon gasoline, which is just, you know, way cheaper than it's been for years.
Well, AAA has a report that's easy to find out. Like, that's one of those statistics you can get is what's the gas price? And so the current average is $1.86 a gallon nationwide. And a year ago it's $2.82. So it's dropped about $1 a gallon in a year.
That's incredible. You're talking about distraction, right, Rob? And I think that in general terms, I think we're generally distracted from understanding the important role of energy. We've talked a lot about that, you know, on this podcast. But in this case, there's some real dangers here. I mean, there's opportunities, but there's also some real dangers. So if we've got this demand destruction of energy supplies, fossil fuels in particular, that is could be a benefit in terms of the, you know, think about the climate crisis. But we have this situation where take fracking, you're talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline taking, you know, tight oil from the Bakken. You can almost make a case that like they don't need that pipeline,
right?
You know, at all, because different parts of the country are different. But as it is, the fracking industry has not been making a profit, you know, for a long time. This is when prices were much higher, and it was propped up by cheap debt and, you know, low interest rates, which were driving investors to put money into things. And so these companies were drilling like crazy. And here we were as a country touting our, you know, we're going to become energy independent and, you know, oil exporters and have these visions for this, you know, long-term abundance of fossil fuels. And climate activists and environmental activists, health activists, you know, people really concerned about the impacts on communities are obviously opposing it. But this whole idea that like we have all the supply, and it was propped up. And we've been warning at PCI, we've been warning people that, you know, this stuff is short-lived. It's very quick to deplete, you know, so we shouldn't be counting on this stuff. But now we are in a situation where the price has cratered so much, you mm-hmm. know, that this industry, we're going to see lots of bankruptcies happening within the fracking industry. And in fact, I think that might have been part of Russia's motivation was to not try to lower output because they want to see the U.S. industry go bust.
Right. Like if Russia and Saudi Arabia can keep gas prices low by letting their output just keep flowing off of their oil fields, then you're saying the fracking industry in the U.S. cannot afford to operate at such low prices. But you know what's amazing, though, talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline, on the other side, Bill McKibben has an article, Bill McKibben, a post-carbon fellow, about the Keystone Pipeline, which you remember is the one that takes oil, tar sands oil, out of Canada and has it flowing south into the U.S. The company there, TC Energy, has been using the pandemic as a good time to resume construction on that pipeline. They figure, it's hard to protest because you got to have social distancing.
Is that really is it literally like they're saying strategically it's safer for us to go build this now?
Who knows what the guys at TC Energy are thinking, but they've got construction workers and they're going forward on it. And yeah, I don't know. It says something about maybe they're not even that profitable, but
right.
My God, we're going to finish this pipeline,
Well, that's amazing because, the stats out of AAA are incredible. So gasoline consumption is down 44% in the U.S., which is about 5 million barrels a day of gasoline consumption. It's just cratered. And of course, we were about 10 million barrels a day of oil production in the U.S. So that's just shocking. That's like we don't need half of our production right now, just from our own internal consumption, let alone of gasoline, let alone other things like kerosene for jets. And
I think that there are a lot of risks here that because we're focused on more acute risks right now, with the pandemic and the economic fallout, there are risks here. On the one hand, industry has to basically retrench, right? And ramp down production, cut back. They're not going to put money into trying to discover new fields or, new promising technologies or whatever. And then we have the situation where if we're able to kind of go back to business as Trump wants us to do, and we talked about a V-shaped recovery before, which is the idea that the economy goes down, but then it can recover very quickly back up. So we try to get people to go back out there.
Right.
In the meantime, industry has been cutting back. So whenever we want to really try to recover and stoke demand again, is there going to be a situation where we have this crunch, this gap? Now we have a gap where supply is outstripping demand. Will we have a gap then where demand is outstripping supply? And that's just from the standpoint of thinking like we should be, we need this stuff, fossil fuels lubricate the blood of the entire economic system, which is true right now. And we just want to, get that right. But from a climate standpoint, this is really hurting the renewable industry really badly as well, when you've got low prices and all the issues with supply chains. So there's a risk where we haven't built out the replacement for fossil fuels in the meantime either.
No. And there's no incentive to do it anymore because it is so cheap to fossil fuels. First they were talking about V-shaped recovery. Then they started saying, well, maybe it's a U-shaped recovery. What if it's an L-shaped recovery, right?
Like an L on your forehead, like a loser recovery?
Well, that's, that refers to sort of permanent damage being done to the economy where it really never gets back to the level it was before. And we start, shaking out all these energy consuming activities that were really just superfluous. I've had trouble with that word in the past and I'm having trouble today. But what is an essential service nowadays, And who do we really need to work? And I just wonder if there's so much damage done for things like tourism, that it's going to be almost impossible to really recover to the previous levels and anytime soon.
Well, and it depends then, really is the narrative really matters, because the narrative we're going to hear is, hey, get back out there. It's safe to go out. Now take your trip to, Disney World, or take your trip to Acapulco, or get on a cruise ship again, because and everything is cheap because the industry is trying to get back on. And let's try to restoke demand versus, the other narrative is to say, hey, look, this was a really, really tough time and it showed us what matters. Our healthcare system matters, essential services being the food that we get, community support, these kinds of things. We don't need to go on a fucking cruise. Let's figure out how to, celebrate things and have experiences in our own communities.
Yeah. And you said something that was really interesting to me, Jason, about the incentive, right? I mean, there the economic incentive may be there to burn oil again and, you know, re-enter the economy, but that on some level that makes no sense. There's a huge incentive not to burn the oil, right? I mean, we all know about that. It's just that our economy can't add that to its rational approach, or, you know, what we might term its irrational approach. But, you know, if prices are the signal for everything and determine the actions of people in the market, then it doesn't make sense to say not burn that oil and in the meantime work on developing the renewable energy sector. But from a systems perspective, looking at the whole thing, it makes huge sense to say, okay, we suddenly have this glut of oil supply, and the economy is slowed down, so people aren't doing the regular stuff that they're used to doing. How about this as the time to really start building out a different energy infrastructure? And that's going to take big leadership.
That's going to take, in a sense, nationalizing the energy sector. It's sort of like what Cuomo was talking about with PPE. It doesn't make sense in a situation like this that we have, that we let the open market basically have states competing against each other, and even the federal government competing against states, you know, for these supplies. We need to basically say this the market can't solve this problem. And we should recognize, even while we're in the midst of this particular crisis, that there's going to be more crises to come, right? So if we said the energy sector, we already have calls to basically bail out the energy sector in the United States. If we're going to do that, well, can we control where those hydrocarbons are being put?
Right. Is it going to be to get people to Disneyland again? Or is it going to do something actually useful for the long term?
We had calls previously for a Green New Deal, you know, where we already had an economy that wasn't working for most people. I mean, those times almost seem quaint now, but it was really tough times for the majority of Americans. And this vision of, okay, we have this climate crisis. We've got a crisis where there's an increasing gap between the haves and have-nots, people being left behind. So let's create jobs in the renewable energy sector. And now we have even more of a case for that. But it really does require saying, okay, we have these resources. This industry is hurting. Let's step in. In fact, there have been calls for that. You know, our friends at the Next System Project have sort of laid out a proposal. This is years ago, before any, you know, a hint of the pandemic, of basically saying, and their idea was actually buy up shares, you know, in majority state companies.
You're saying the government would buy the stock of oil companies, basically? So this is, to me, an idea whose time has come. I mean, I agree completely that the market has failed in producing the outcome you would want, which is preventing climate change. So the question then, though, is could we do some sort of nationalization in a way that you could feel good about and trust? And that's a really big question. I mean, it totally depends on what kind of policies let's say the federal government says, okay, we've stepped in and we control energy. It's really dependent on how good they are at implementing policy and really what's the motivation of that policy. Obviously, if the motivation is just to be the world leader in oil production or to be the profit maximizers like the market was trying, then, you know, you're not going to get any kind of outcome that you would want.
Yeah, so good.
I guess maybe you could say I have trust issues.
It's a leadership question, obviously. And right now, you know, we have leadership in this country that arguably is the most friendly to fossil fuel and corporate interests that we've ever had. And sorry, Cheney, I know that you wanted to keep that crown on your head.
But he tried.
I don't know that he's been dethroned. Come on now.
But, you know, so, you know, be careful of that. You know, I wish we could say we actually had a very small case of this where the first stimulus package was being debated in Congress, right? And there was actually it got sort of bogged down because Democrats were arguing for trying to put like fuel efficiency standards and some things into the bailout for the airline industry, right? And the Republicans were decrying this, you know, as like as a distraction, as a kind of this little, this is the wrong time to be demanding these kinds of things. You know, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. We got to bail these guys out right now. Imagine a situation where the oil industry, you know, is coming to the government saying, we need a bailout right now. You got to help us. We're hemorrhaging. We're going to go out of business. You know, and they could make a strong case to say, if we go bust, people are come this winter, you know what I mean? Talk about natural gas. People are not going to be able to heat their homes. You know, we're going to have real issues here. And they would be right about that. And the government feels like, okay, yeah, we got to bail these guys out. Now Trump and those folks might say, these are our friends. These are our donors. You know, these are our clients. We got to do what they need. Could the Democrats then come and say, sure, we'll bail these guys out, but let's do it in this way?
Just think of the opportunity that's in front of us. I mean, we're already figuring out how to live on a lot less oil, a lot less need for transportation. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, everybody's living the way they want to right now, but we're figuring things out. And so you could see how we could really reduce demand for fossil fuels. At the same time, I mean, it was Easter Sunday yesterday, and I have solar panels on the roof that I got installed last year as part of incentive programs. And we produced almost 50 kilowatt hours of electricity, way more than we would use as a household, you know, probably even for a week or a month, even if we're really being careful. So with renewable energy programs, if we could invest wisely and get local infrastructure set up, wow. I mean, just the possibility that here's a turning point time and we're getting used to using less fossil fuels. We could get used to using more renewables. It just seems ripe for change.
Here's a call to action, you know, which is we need to steward these resources, these fossil fuels, to help with the energy transition and really dedicate, you know, them to the food system. I mean, we can have a whole conversation about the risks of the food system and the things that we're already seeing right now. These systems that we have right now, we've built this world as highly vulnerable and dependent on fossil fuels. And the ones that are the most important uses, mm-hmm. nothing more important than food, should be prioritized. So when I look, I've you know, been privy to conversations and discussions amongst climate, you know, environmental groups, seeing this as a real opportunity right now that the oil prices are down and oil companies are hurting. And some of the attitude I've seen is, yeah, let's kick them while they're down. You know what I mean? With this is not thinking systemically about the situation that we're in. So instead of saying, yeah, fuck those guys, you know, let them fail, recognizing, well, no, the renewable energy transition depends upon us having access to these resources. And they're hurting right now. So let's say, instead of saying, yeah, let's make a deal, instead of saying these guys are villains or evil,
let's make a deal.
You know, we don't want to have anything to do with them. Let's figure out a way to control where those resources go.
Give them a chance for redemption.
Now,
right?
You may not be able to get anywhere with the Trump administration, but progressives and environmental activists could be really, really pushing, you know, Congress to push for those kinds of demands. You know, as part of, we're going to have more and more stimulus packages and interventions from the government. So there's going to be these opportunities, and we need to kind of fight over that ground right now.
Yeah. You know, a couple of years ago, I read an argument by a really well-regarded pundit about the need to take fossil fuel and use it for the farms so that we can get the food system prepared and going towards regenerative agriculture. Look, Jason just crossed his arms, put his feet up because he knew I was talking about him. No, it was a really good article. It was about, hey, people, if you want to have food and you want to have a resilient ag system and you want to work on building the fertility of soils, let's take the fossil fuel we have and use it now to help us with the transition toward an organic, a more local economy or local food economy where we can actually wean ourselves off of the fossil fuels.
We can't just let the market dictate it. Just, you know, so no, this is a good opportunity. People are seeing the failures of the market. We got Cuomo talking about the failures of the market. We have other governors talking about the failures of the market. So this is a perfect opportunity to say we can't just leave it to the market to do that.
Yeah, so I think you're right, Asher. That is sort of, I take as my marching orders, the idea of pushing that fossil fuels get used toward reinventing the energy infrastructure into renewables, and that we use it for transitioning our farms to a more regenerative state.
And as we're talking about this, to also recognize, what do we actually need energy for? What matters for us? Because it's not like we want to see, it's a much easier of a transition if we've already reduced demand significantly, right?
Yeah.
So let's not try to just push demand to go way back up in the really superfluous ways.
Right. Let's push for an L-shaped recovery.
That's going to be such a great, great selling pitch. Yeah.
Okay. So we, during the pandemic, we've decided to share our reflections in the quarantine corner. So I wanted to tell you two guys about something I saw the other day. I was getting pretty stir crazy and had to go out on a bike ride. There's a nice bike path here. I had sort of scouted it. It's actually really wide, so I didn't feel like I was going to be getting too close to anybody else by riding it. And I got out on it, and it was pretty good. There, people, by and large, had really good social distancing behavior. You know, there was like 10 feet between you and the next person. However, I came to one spot where this family was sitting on a park bench, and then this other guy had decided to stop and talk with them. And he was on the other side of the path, socially distancing himself, talking to this family.
Oh,
but
wait, there's a problem.
You're threading the needle.
Exactly. There's no way to get through there.
Yeah, both of them breathing and coughing on you.
Yeah. 5 feet
it's
from
the
each
gauntlet.
Party. And I just...
the coronavirus gauntlet.
Exactly. I was like, it's some kind of medieval torture setup or something. But it really got me thinking about what...
Hold your breath.
It got me thinking, like, you know, what do we do if we need to maintain social distancing and there's people who are kind of clueless about it, or there's people who just don't care? You know, what's the proper response? Do you gotta confront them? Do you gotta get in these rude conversations? What do you think?
Cattle prongs.
I think stun guns, you know, with extra super long, you know, what do they call those? You know, the ribbons that come out.
Yeah.
I knew I could count on you guys to give me really good solutions here, both of which involve shooting electrical currents into the people.
Well, we were talking about what's energy good for, you know, put it to the highest uses, right?
It's high voltage, low amps. It's fine.
I don't know. I think it's a tricky one because I actually think I'm worried right now that we're going to see, look, we're going to the second month of this thing, right? People are going to go more and more stir crazy, you know, and as we flatten the curve more and more, people are going to feel less and less urgency, you know, and we're definitely going to get either mixed messages or direct messages from Trump saying, you know, okay, let's open things up again. So we're going to have more and more of these situations where people are going to be kind of blowing the stuff off. You know, and do you want to be that cranky, get off my lawn guy, right? You know, yelling at people, you know?
I've always dreamed of being that guy anyway, you know?
Well, this is, you got lots of opportunity to practice that and hone your skills.
I
don't know. What do you do in a situation like that? Stop and passively aggressively say to the guy, really?
Well, my life consists of a series of mistakes I made, followed up by me figuring out what I should have done afterwards. So here's what I should have done here. What I did was exactly what you said, Jason, just held my breath and blew on through and then kind of thought to myself, what a bunch of jackasses. But then I thought all I needed to do was stop and ask the guy on the left side of the path to cross over to the right side while still maintaining 6 feet or more of distance from the family he's talking to. And he probably would have, since he was practicing social distancing, he probably would have agreed, and it wouldn't have been even that awkward of a conversation. But oh well, hindsight.
We'll get back on your bike. I'm sure you'll have another experience like that soon.
Yes. Yeah. We will learn all these tricks.
That's right. I'm sure. Well, you Jason brought up a question a few minutes ago about what are essential services. And I know you were telling me about your adventures in essential service land.
Oh yeah. Well, I went downtown for the first time in a couple of weeks, a few days ago. And I thought, let me see, is there stuff open I want to do? My wife wanted me to get batteries for thermometers. Our thermometer batteries are dead. I wish I had analog thermometers, but apparently because of mercury and stuff, they don't even make them. So we have these digital thermometers, you know, supply chain dependencies and stuff now are a problem.
For a farmer, are you talking about for health or are you talking about for your compost pile?
Well, this is my compost pile has one that's old school. I love it. It's long. It's not a huge long thing too. I stick it in 3 feet, but no, this is for health. My wife actually got tested. She was feeling bad and we quarantined her in the house, but we didn't have a working thermometer. The batteries were dead.
Oh, not good.
So we're like, let's not be in this situation again. She tested negative. She's fine. But, so we had a scare, right? We had a scare and we're like, we don't have thermometers at work. So I go down and like, sure enough, this battery store is open, you know, but all kinds of stuff. Yes. It's a store that specializes in battery. He knew exactly what we need. Oh, you need this battery. And he got it for me, but there wasn't gloves. There wasn't hand sanitizer. He wasn't even wearing anything. I was wearing a face mask, but I'm going, my gosh, so much was open. And I felt like, you know, here in Oregon, we have a program in place. You know, the governor did something. I think she took a little too long, but we apparently did something just in time to save our hospitals. And there's new models coming out that were, you know, Oregon's probably going to stay under a surge capacity if we keep this up. But you know what? We're not plummeting the infection rate. Our infection rate is kind of staying steady. Mm-hmm. And I worry if we loosen any more, like you're saying, Rob, it's going to go up because we are right on the edge and we're not nearly putting the hammer down as much as a place like Italy or Spain. And so it's fascinating. Like we are really trying to keep a lot of businesses going, which I understand, but I also don't think we're staying on top of the infection rate.
Yeah.
Here, at least here right now. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. Different places are going to have different levels of it.
Businesses get to choose for themselves if they're essential or not, right?
I don't know exactly. I mean, I think certain things were shut down, like movie theaters. There were certain things that absolutely had to be shut down.
Well, in our town, you know, I don't want to pick on a specific business, but there's, you know, there's a store that sells like new and used sports equipment.
Yes, that's open. You know? Yep.
They're open.
Yep.
They're open. How is that essential? I mean, it's important for people to be able to get exercise. I'm going crazy because I can't go to the gym.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought about getting like gym equipment or whatever, but is that essential?
Exactly. That's what I found driving around. Like, wow, a lot's open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's hard. I mean, to ask any one person what activity is essential. And in the moment, you know, you say, you think, oh, I should go out and get X, Y, or Z or go and do this thing. Is that really necessary? And it's hard. I mean, I think people are making decisions based on, you know, essentially how they feel or what the weather is like they normally would.
Or what my wife told me to do.
But also these businesses, you know, I mean, look, they want to stay open.
Yes.
They want to, you know, and they want to be able to take care of their employees. They're in a really tough situation.
Totally. Yeah.
So asking them to decide on their own to basically put their employees out of work,
right.
You know what I mean? And shut down. That's a really hard thing to ask of them.
This is why we really need a competent administration at the federal level to really say, we're going to do this hard for a couple of weeks. Like if everybody did it hard for a couple of weeks, but we knew we were going to support payroll and healthcare and people aren't going to go out of business, we could do it. But because we're kind of muddling our way through, it's not efficient.
And I really worry that we're going to muddle through when we try to get out of this thing.
Yeah.
You know, if we don't have widespread testing,
right?
You know, how the hell do we know? It's remarkable. Well, I wanted to, you know, quarantine corner, right? So I want to talk about a little bit just about the experience of what our kids are going through. And our kids are different ages. My boys are 14, one just literally had his birthday last week, turned 14 in quarantine.
Wow.
And the other's 9. And they just, you know, canceled school for the rest of the year. They're doing distance learning, you know. So right now, while we're talking, my oldest is on probably a Zoom call or some kind of, no, I think it's Google Classroom thing. And, you know, it's funny. I will preface this by saying we are ridiculously fortunate, you know, my family, and maybe you guys feel the same way. You know, mm-hmm. I still have my job. We have a lovely home. We have all the food that we need. We're not scared. I don't have to go out in order to earn, you know, income for my family, go out and put myself at risk. I'm not worried about us not being able to pay our mortgage and our other bills, you know, or where the food comes from. So we're very, very fortunate. Even with that, you know, just think about this generation of kids who will have gone through this experience. Who knows how long it's going to be? Just trying to imagine what this experience will have been for them, you know, later in life. So my 14-year-old, you know, he's in eighth grade. He's going to be graduating. He's probably not going to have a graduation ceremony. He doesn't really care about that, but he's bummed out that they didn't get to get out of school early for this graduation and have a party with his friends. And even more bummed out because he's really into sports. He's really into soccer and he's into running, right? So he had this vision in his head that in eighth grade, he was going to make the meet of champions in the state of Oregon because they run all grades together, right? Yeah. And he...
Nice.
And this was his last chance in eighth grade because he's, you know, sort of the oldest. And he's a kid who hasn't gone through, you know, his growth spurt yet. So he's going up against, you should actually see pictures sometimes. Like,
yes.
He's like literally at the armpit of other kids that he's running against. You know, he's like, this is going to be the year that I'm going to make, you know, meet of champions. And that's been taken away from him, you know, and all his soccer stuff has been taken away from him. Being away from their friends for, you know, for months. Right.
Yeah.
They'll be out of school for 5.5 months if they're able to go back to school, you know, in the fall. Like, what are they going to be the long term? There's, you know, jokes about people in the Great Depression, how, you know, they're so worried if they see a penny on the ground, they had to be picked up, you know, because that was their experience as kids, you know. You know, what's going to be the experience for our kids, you know, growing up?
Well, yeah. On the plus side, kids tend to be more resilient. So maybe we should be worried about our old selves and how we deal with it.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. I just, you know, and as far as hardships go, I think this is, you know, my mother always says, you know, puts hair on your chest. You know, there's hardships that are like not that bad. You know what I mean? Don't show me your chest yet right now, Jason.
Sorry.
God, our listeners aren't seeing this. you know, like I think it's a healthy experience to go through some tough times, you know, and like I said, relatively speaking, this is not that tough compared
not that tough yet. Yeah.
So it could be a positive experience. Who knows?
I mean, the bonding that I'm seeing, like say within families could be good. Like, you know, you might have a chance to really get close to your kids at this stage in their life and have an interesting experience together that you can reflect on. I know like we're doing video chats with my extended family right now. And I'm seeing like my aunts and uncles and cousins and stuff. And it's like 20 of us talking and we never used to do anything like that.
Yeah. You
know? So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. It does provide a chance to connect. Although I have to say the connections are not quite as good as if they were in person, obviously, but you know, that probably wouldn't have happened under, you know, quote unquote normal times. You know, it's not like, you can take this special circumstance and say, oh, we would have done this connecting time had the coronavirus not been an issue. So, I don't know. Maybe it is a chance to figure out what's important and to learn how to engage with people that we wouldn't have otherwise. And that can be a real plus for them as they grow up and turn into adults.
I do miss my tennis buddies and playing tennis, though.
Well, you can play virtual tennis with them online.
It doesn't really work.
Yeah.
No. Too bad.
I know.
Well, that's our quarantine corner for this week. Thanks, Asher and Jason, for sharing your experiences there. And we'd like to invite our listeners, if you've got experiences you want to share, send us an email at crazytown@postcarbon.org.
Hey, good catching up, guys.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy this time with you two. Good stuff.
All right, talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk soon.
Okay, bye.